How is the landscape of graduate medical education changing? What is on the horizon for residency interviews after the COVID-19 pandemic? Let's learn the answers together on this episode of the Talk to Me Doc podcast. Our sponsor today is Panacea Financial. As the company founded by doctors, they know how frustrating it can be to work with financial companies, which is why they've created a better way. Have you thought about refinancing your student loans? Well, unlike any other companies, the rates you get at Panacea Financial for a student loan refinance don't go up because of your credit score, how much debt you have, or your income level. With no loan maximums or cosigner requirement, their student loan refinance is based on the respect physicians deserve and not on a credit score or debt level. Join the growing number of physicians nationwide that expected more from their bank and switch to Panacea Financial. You can visit PanaceaFinancial.com today for a better way to refinance your student loans.
Welcome to the Talk to Me Doc podcast, where it's all about serving the early career physician. Let's talk about the unique issues that face us so we can create a better future for ourselves and those to come. And now your host, Dr. Andrew Tisser.
Hey everybody, it's Andrew. Welcome back to the Talk to Me Doc podcast. I'm so glad you're here. For my returning listeners, thank you so much. For my new listeners, welcome. Because today, like on every episode, we're talking to the best guests from all around healthcare and beyond to discuss issues relating to the early career physician. Today, I'm bringing Jason Remnick onto the show. He's the CEO and founder of Thalamus, the premier cloud-based interview management platform for graduate medical education training programs. He's passionate about medical innovation, education, and technology, and his work has been featured in leading medical journals, including Anesthesia and Analgesia, the Journal of Graduate Medical Education, and the Journal of the American Medical Association. He is the director of the Society of Physician Entrepreneurs Nashville chapter and served as an advisor at the Nashville Entrepreneur Center. Dr. Remnick trained in the combined pediatrics anesthesiology program at Stanford University and graduated AOA from the University of Rochester School of Medicine while concurrently earning his MBA from the Simon Graduate School of Business. He is recognized as a physician of tomorrow and recipient in 2012 by the American Medical Association, was a member of the Stanford University Society of Physician Scholars from 2013 to 2017, and was a Joseph Collins Foundation Fellow from 2011 to 2013. Well, let's get Jason onto the show. Jason Remnick, welcome to the Talk to Me Doc podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So I pre-recorded a little bit about you for the listeners, but in your own words, could you tell us kind of who you are, what you do, and what your role is in healthcare?
Sounds great. Yeah. So Jason Remnick, physician by training, now the CEO and founder of Thalamus, which is a GME residency and fellowship interview management platform, scheduling interviews for applicants and residency and fellowship programs all across the country.
That's awesome. Certainly very well needed. I think, you know, it's been a little while since I applied to residency, but it was kind of crazy, if I remember correctly.
It is a process, for sure.
So how does your platform help exactly? Is it just schedules the interviews, or like is it on the program side or on the applicant side, or how does it work?
Yeah, it's kind of on all different sides. So it came out of my own experience applying to residency in 2012 and got stuck in New York City during Hurricane Sandy. And my co-founder, her name is Susie Karen, she was my mentor in med school, a former program director and now an associate DIO. So we were approaching it from all different sides, trying to streamline this process for everyone. So it integrates with your application services that everyone's using. So Aris, SF Match, other softwares as well. The programs are able to pull in data about the candidates, everything from characteristics to board scores, contact information, et cetera, and then invite them to interview. And for the applicant, it works very similar to OpenTable. They get an email with a link to create a profile, and takes less than 10 seconds to do that. And then they are brought to a calendar that shows interview availability from the programs that have invited them in real time. And then they're able to coordinate and pick which interview they'd like to schedule. They can add themselves to wait lists. And then back on the program side, it's a very process-specific applicant tracking system. So they can score candidates, they can rank candidates, write notes on them, build face sheets, and everything they need to do preparing for the match, export their rank list, and then upload it into the NRMP, for instance. With the pandemic, it's now doing a lot more. We have a virtual interview platform built in. We also integrate with Zoom, Teams, and WebEx. We have schedule and itinerary builders for programs that use various AI, and even helping out with application review to allow for using a technology-enabled holistic review as well. So it's really grown into a pretty powerful platform. We're used by over 2,500 residency and fellowship programs throughout the country at around a little over 200 institutions right now and growing, and about 90% of all applicants are using us as well.
Wow, that's awesome. Yeah, my my wife is a program director for a medicine program here in town, and so I have some personal interest in it as well, because just seeing what she goes through every year when it comes to the to application season, it's a whirlwind of craziness.
Oh, for sure. It's a lot of stress and anxiety on both the applicants and the program leadership, the program coordinators. It's just, there's still a lot of inefficiency to unwind. And that's really what we're trying to do now for the future as well.
So the, there's a lot of buzz right now about holistic review, 360 review, et cetera. And, looking at more of just more than just board scores and other things that have been used as cutoffs in the past. Do you think that Thalamus helps in regards to making the process a little bit more equitable, or, and if so, how?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's actually a really big part of our mission that we're really trying to bring to the forefront in the coming years now. And so, you know, our first initiative was to try and make interview scheduling easier, and I think we've done that. There's lots of talk at the national level about the number of applications that have increased year over year, deemed application inflation. So candidates are submitting more and more applications to programs. In essence, what that's doing is it's causing programs to have to review more applications, and in some cases, extend more interview invitations than they have in the past as well, which creates real issues with transparency and understanding which applicants are really targeting which programs and which programs are targeting which applicants. And so, there's been a big push, as I think is correct, to make this process a lot more equitable, is to do a holistic review and consider every single piece of someone's application. But when you have this many applications coming in that need to be reviewed, you know, it's kind of an opposing force preventing that from taking full flight. So we believe in technology on our team. We believe in equity and making this process more fair for everyone. We have some tools that use natural language processing and optical character recognition to help screen applications, not to eliminate anyone, but just to aggregate data. And so we've seen that residency programs, to do a true holistic review, they have to look through applications manually by hand, which takes a lot of time. We have programs in, like Iowa, who are counting how many times the word Iowa appears in an application, trying to find a signal. Is this candidate really considering coming to a program in Iowa? And everyone has all these different formulas and such, but it relies on the data being readily available. And so that's one thing our application screening tool, which we call Cortex, does. It pulls this data out and organizes it in a much easier to view user interface and streamlines the review process to allow for a greater holistic review. While at the same time, there's definitely both conscious and unconscious biases that exist in all of us, and especially in reviewing applications. We've built ways into our review and in both Cortex and Thalamus, our scheduling tool proper, to blind various fields. So programs can choose to hide certain categories from the faculty. This can be the candidate's name, it can be their photo, it can be their gender, it can be their ethnicity, whatever fields they want to hide. If they want to completely blind themselves to USMLE or COMLEX scores, they could do that as well. And we're really trying to find technology-driven solutions that can help level the playing field for everyone so that programs really can do a holistic review. And we're backing that up with a large number of research into this process and trying to understand, with true evidence-based, data-driven solutions, how can we streamline this for programs and for applicants to really allow for more transparency in the process overall.
That's great. Yeah. I mean, honestly, my wife went through every single applicant this year, and there was thousands of them, and a lot more than usual, I think, probably pandemic related, but yeah, just to be able to find some signal as to, you know, we're in Buffalo. It's not the part of the country everyone wants to be in. Sure. But why, you know, what is the purpose of application versus the people that want to be here versus the people that are just adding a couple to their list? And I think, especially this past cycle, people added a lot more programs to their list, just A, because they didn't have to travel, and B, they were worried, you know?
Yeah.
So do you think that's going to continue? Do you think there's going to be like a hybrid virtual and in-person interviews, or what do you think is going to happen?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And this year was certainly a very unique year, perhaps the most unique year in the history of GME recruitment, in that everything went virtual. And I think that brought a lot of uncertainty to the process, which really increased both anxiety and really just signal for the process in general. And so, you know, we had a lot of applicants coming to us, asking us or asking through their medical schools or otherwise, you know, how many programs should I apply to this year? And similarly for the residency programs, how many should we interview? Should we interview more people? Should we target more on the surrounding geography and such? And so there was a lot of what ifs this year, and it really led to general concern in the community, this idea of interview hoarding, which is that more select group of applicants is accounting for the majority of the interviews. So your top tier candidates are getting more interviews than it being equally distributed amongst the whole distribution of applicants. And there was concern for it, and you know, perhaps rightly so, in that because everything was virtual, there was less opportunity cost. You know, in a normal year, candidates may spend up to $25,000 in travel all around the country, and that cost was eliminated in everything going virtual. And so would candidates hang on to more interviews? And if only the top tier was getting interviews and they went to all the interviews they were invited to, would there be enough interviews left for the rest of the distribution of candidates? And similarly, if it wasn't spread out enough and not enough candidates interviewed in not enough places, would the match have resulted in less filled positions? And there were lots of editorials that came out postulating a match crisis, you know, significant percentages of specialties and programs not filling. And there was a lot of general concern. And so going back to what I was talking about earlier with the data, we measure a lot of this and we're growing. We account for about 15% of the total program population in the country right now. In some specialties, we have up to 50 or 60% of the programs. And so we have from a statistical perspective, what we believe to be a very generalizable and reliable sample population. So we're looking at this, and we wrote about it on our blog and put out some publications and such as well, that the distribution of interviews amongst programs had not changed. So if you compared any two programs throughout the country, the overlap between those two programs was consistent from last year and now the year prior. And so nothing was really looking very different compared to prior data. At the same time, the applicants, right, if there was an interview hoarding problem, you'd expect that distribution to change in terms of the average number of interviews per applicant. And that didn't change either. It was this nice sort of exponentially decaying curve. And so the concern around the country is that there is interview hoarding. And you know, I really think that term needs to be defined somewhat more. It's a great term. I just think it's creating a lot of anxiety. Everybody knows someone who's interviewed at 50 or 60 programs, and that exists and that happens, but that is not the norm. That is a very, very small percentage of the population. So what we actually saw this year was, in perhaps a compensatory mechanism, programs interviewed, they had the same number of interview invitations that went out, but they completed more interviews. So they made a conscious effort to offer more interview spots. Similarly, candidates across the board canceled less. But on the whole, everybody, regardless of where you were in that distribution, completed more interviews. And so that actually provided some buffer, we believe, to the match, and which is why, you know, most of the match positions filled. Only 1,927 positions were left unfilled by the time the main match completed. And then by the time SOAP ended, only 7 spots were remaining across the entire country. And so, you know, on a lot of people are jumping on that the match rates decreased this year. And that is true. But the reason for that isn't because the match is less efficient or effective. It's more you have more candidates applying to residency than the compensatory increase in the number of spots around the country, which is, of course, a big issue and is talked a lot about in policy and growing GME spots. But in terms of the math of the match, it was, you know, what they like to call the thickness of the match was maintained. And that's why, you know, the match was very similar. Going forward, this, of course, is probably going to set up for another virtual interview season this year. It's possible that there's some sort of hybrid model that takes place. There's lots of concerns about equity if that is to occur. So the Coalition of Physician Accountability has called for an all-virtual interview season. OBGYN as a specialty has called for an all-virtual interview season. And it seems like many other specialties will soon follow. But there's probably a hybrid that's going to exist more in the future, which I think a lot of programs are beginning to talk about. And it's the idea of you use virtual as an equitable screen, as they do in many other industries, right? It's very easy for us to have phone calls. It's very easy for us to get on a video call these days. And it's a lot cheaper for both applicants and programs. The challenge with that, of course, is if you're applying to residency, somewhere you're going to spend 3 to 7 years of your life, you may match there without ever having seen the hospital, the surrounding environment, the city that it's in, et cetera. So the idea then of a second look that people could then be invited to and attend. And so, you know, only so many people have been to Buffalo. I went to medical school in Rochester. You know, they're both upstate New York, lake effect snow, not major hubs of cities that most people have traveled to. Like it in some ways, you know, handicaps those institutions a bit. So this would be a way to sort of level the playing field there as well. And then candidates wouldn't have to travel as much as they would have prior because they're only traveling to institutions that they're strongly considering after that screening interview, for instance. And so that also creates some signal between applicants and programs. And I think there's a lot to look into there. It needs to be studied a bit more, but I think that that could potentially be the future of what this interview season looks like. Will there be some in-person interviews this year? It's possible. Some institutions are considering it. It seems to be, you know, hotly debated, and many of the specialty organizations or otherwise are trying to put policy out to provide some just general guidelines for the specialty. So we'll see. But for right now, the two organizations, Coalition of Physician Accountability and the OBGYN organization, both spoke up so far and said we're recommending all virtual.
Interesting. That's very interesting about the data. I certainly thought it would have there would have been more hoarding, and there would have it would have looked a lot different. So, you know, just conceptually. So right. that is really interesting to note. I think from an equity standpoint, that certainly makes a lot of sense. I mean, people that have, you know, who has $25,000 unless they're being they're, you know, putting everything on credit cards or borrowing money from family or using loans or whatever to be able to run all over the country. Whereas, you know, some people really can't do that, but they can certainly go to 10 Zoom interviews. So really brings up some interesting topics. As far as the bottleneck itself, you know, a lot of that's got to come from federal policy, right? So do you see that bottleneck easing up at all? And it certainly is specialty dependent, right? But then you look at a specialty like my own of emergency medicine, whereas no one can find a job right now. There's, you know, new residencies everywhere. Popping up, and then it's the worst job market we've ever seen in emergency medicine, somewhat perhaps due to increased residency spots and somewhat due to COVID and lack of volumes and people cutting hours and such. But
sure.
You know, where do you see the bottleneck going in the next 5 years, let's say?
Yeah, well, I think fortunately it is being talked about more at the national level. You know, there are bills that have been presented to Congress that are still active and going through. I think there's no lack of awareness that we're going to have a shortage of physicians over the next decades, and we need to sort of fill that. But at the same time, sort of as you alluded to there, just because we're having a shortage of physicians, it's got to be a targeted way that we increase spots. Because emergency medicine is having a bit of a job crisis right now. And part of that is because the number of emergency medicine residency spots have increased significantly compared to other specialties. And so the specialties need to get together and find out where those shortages are. While at the same time, you know, this has to come from federal policy because CMS pays for residency training all across the country. Each hospital gets about $100,000 per resident that they trained for a spot that's funded. About 50 to 60% of that goes to the resident's salary. The other 40, 50, 60% that's remaining goes to what's known as indirect costs, which are meant to ensure that the hospital has a certain case mix so that everyone can be accredited and see enough of a diverse patient population to see what they're supposed to see in the specialty that they're training in. And so that funding needs to increase spots. There's a lot of different models that have gone into this. But yeah, I agree with you. I think we definitely need more physicians. We definitely need physicians in several underserved areas throughout the country, mostly in rural areas that tend to have smaller population centers. But it really is up to us, I think, as physicians and as specialty leaders and physician leaders to understand where are the holes within our specialty, because we're all facing different challenges. Similarly to what we're doing with Thalamus in the residency match, every specialty is very different. So it's hard to talk about each specialty as this blanket, we need to change this for everybody, because everyone faces different challenges. And the same goes for practice and in terms of reimbursement models and state licensure, and it becomes a very multifactorial environment out there. And so when you change one variable, so if you just say, well, let's increase the number of residency spots, you know, you could get into a position that emergency medicine's in here, or a pandemic could come around, or you could, you know, have to worry about the mix of the types of students that are getting into various areas, and are they training in medical school for one area, but then needing to go to a separate geography for residency because that's closer to their families. And there are all these macro and microeconomic sociologic things to consider to really affect this policy. But I think almost without saying, we're going to need more physicians one way or another. It just needs to be targeted in the way we do it.
Yeah, that's fair. Well, what about the changes to board exams, right? So, you know, step one going pass fail, and then step two CS getting eliminated. Mm-hmm. How is that gonna, you know, what's that gonna do? I mean, I think it's all very, I think that's a smart decision personally, yeah. But mm-hmm. How is that gonna change residency recruitment, interview opportunities, et cetera? What do you think?
Yeah, it's another great question. I think the jury's still out on it a bit. I think people have different hypotheses as to what's going to happen. I would agree that I think making step one pass fail is a great step. I mean, just I still remember taking my test. It was almost 10 years ago now, and maybe it was a little over 10 years now. And just it's an 8-hour test that you study months of your life for, sort of nonstop. And the numeric score was never meant to be a metric that people were to be judged on, but it became that way. And so the question is, if step one with step one going pass fail, is that our program's going to turn their attention to step two CK, or the perceived rank or strength of the medical school, or some other metric? And so I think it's definitely the right decision. It also provides a unique opportunity for GME and medical education to try and see what are we really assessing for here. And so I think there's a lot being postulated, from psychometric assessments to just holistic review, and defining exactly what holistic review is for a program or a specialty versus what other things can we find in someone's application, and trying to piece all of this together really to take this more holistic, equitable view. And so it's an opportunity, but it's one we have to step up to the challenge to and really figure out how we're going to recruit physicians of the future. But that's also why we're excited at Thalamus with holistic review and using technology as a tool, because technology, as we've learned this year, can really help us push the bar forward, streamline processes, save time. And so I think there's a real opportunity here.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's the right direction. There is a certainly concern for our foreign medical graduate colleagues as well, though, in regards to, and I know they're doing a lot of things to help buffer this step two CS issue, but I wonder what will happen. And I wonder if just with more medical schools, if that bottleneck is going to push some of them out of the system. I don't know. And I don't think either way is right or wrong, but that's not what we're talking about here, but it certainly brings up other interesting points. Like, well, we don't have a CS for someone, for someone from a different country. I don't know what's going to happen with that either.
Right. And there's talk of potentially some other exams coming in, was the purpose of CS just to check English comprehension and ability to speak the English language? And so there are ways to check that. But I don't think that was the only reason that CS existed, but I agree. I think the hurdles that IMGs, international medical graduates, foreign medical graduates have to get through to become licensed in the United States is a challenge. And, it's another thing we need to deal with at the policy level. Is it the goal to have the best physicians from anywhere train in the United States? Is it physicians who've grown up in the United States, who've become citizens? There are some really talented physicians from other countries who've practiced 10, 20, 30 years and could certainly help in terms of our medical system and want to practice here. And so, I don't know what the right or wrong answer is here. I just know we have a lot of people who want to train in the country in a healthcare system that in some ways needs more physicians. So I think we need to just figure out the best ways to move forward for all of these different applicant groups.
Fair enough. Yeah. Any other big changes you see coming over the next few years in regards to how, residency selection, interview process, or residency training in general?
Yeah, I think the pandemic has caused us to reassess a lot of things from just our normal lives and our health to even the GME recruitment process. And there are various specialties attempting new ideas from signal preferencing to universal interview release days to the proposal of a potential early match to interview caps, application caps. I think all of these are interesting ideas and again require just data to be studied and figure out what is the most equitable for these, because we need to just make sure that whatever decisions we're implementing work for everyone entering the match or this recruitment process or whatever be. If you changed one of these variables, what happens to people's behavior and what happens to the ultimate outcome of the match? And so, I think as long as we just do what we do as physicians and measure these things and study them, there's the potential to really come in with a lot of new innovation here.
I agree. I'm hopeful. It's been a long time coming, and I think it's really taken too long. So I think COVID has forced a lot of change in a lot of respects. So I hope I'm hopeful for the best, and I'll be able to watch from the sidelines, not being an academic myself.
Yeah.
we're running out of a little bit of time here. So before we end, I just wanted to get to know you as the guest a little bit more, Jason. So besides Thalmus and keeping up to date on all this policy and everything, what do you like to do for fun?
That's a great question. So my background educationally, besides being pre-med and studying biochemistry, was I was also a theater arts major. So I really like theater and haven't been able to keep up with it as much, especially in the pandemic. But whether it's reading plays or just seeing good theater, and that could be straight plays, it could be musicals, or otherwise, that's a big passion of mine. I have a 16 month old son or 17 month old son today. Wow. Who hasn't seen much of the world yet since at least last March. So would like to get him out into the world and traveling a bit once the pandemic dies down, but enjoy sports as well. And cooking. I've taken to a lot of cooking during the pandemic because it was an activity we could do. So it's been fun.
That's awesome. What's your favorite musical?
My favorite musical is, it's an obscure one, but it's Stephen Sondheim's Assassins. And it's an interesting historical play about the assassins in American history, kind of flipping the script, and as only Sondheim can do in many instances, and seeing the reasons for the assassinations behind from the view of the assassin. And I just think it's just a very clever way of playing with perspective. I've always really liked Sondheim as well, but you know, my top three probably are more mainstream choices: Phantom of the Opera and Les Mis as well.
Yeah, my wife and I haven't seen that one. My wife and I are big theater goers ourselves. She got me into it. I grew up in New York City, but I had never been to a musical before I met my wife. So, gotcha. But that sounds cool. Have you read any good books lately?
I tend to read more plays than books. Right now, I'm on Tim Ferriss's 4-Hour Chef. I had read his 4-Hour Work Week and 4-Hour Body prior. So I like his books, and I think it just fits in well to the entrepreneur lifestyle. But I tend to read more plays. I really like early 1930s kind of American drama. And the reason is it's been really interesting to go through medicine and healthcare. There have been some pretty landmark plays written in that time, one of which is a play called Men in White, which is written by Sidney Kingsley, which is considered to be the original sort of medical drama well before Grey's Anatomy and well before any of the other medical shows and Scrubs and such. But a similar playwright of that time, who I studied pretty thoroughly, Clifford Odets, wrote a play in 1934 called Waiting for Lefty, which also has a vignette that takes place in medicine. And there's one line from that play that sort of also found its way in some ways into Men in White, is that doctors don't run medicine in this country. And so when you look at it from that light, that, you know, almost 90 years ago, we were talking about many of the same topics, like, that drives me as a physician in just wanting to innovate and help us as a profession and as an industry provide better patient care and also just move medicine into the future. So I like to read history in the form of plays. I think it's an interesting way of looking at the past and then making decisions about the future.
That's really interesting, I will say. Yeah. That's cool. Have you read Tools of Titans by Tim Ferriss yet?
Not yet.
That is like read a little bit, read something else for a few months, and then read. It's so much, but it's really like it.
Yeah, as his books grew, they tended to move towards that model where there's some really good stuff in it, but you can't really read it in one sitting.
All right, Jason. Well, if you had one piece of advice for physicians early in their career, what would that one piece of advice be?
Yeah, I get this question a lot, especially since I've taken more of a unconventional path. And I think the advice I really love to give to physicians is that there is no straight pathway to being a successful physician. It takes many different forms. Academia defines it one way, become an expert in your specialty, provide great patient care, and just continue to grow and learn. And if you're going into academic medicine, then writing publications and moving up in your department and otherwise. But, I think that's just one model. And I'm really passionate about physicians being involved in entrepreneurship and innovation. And that doesn't mean everyone has to drop out of medicine and start companies. It doesn't mean everyone has to completely ignore it and just focus on clinical medicine. I think there's this balance that we all need to find. And I think life will throw you surprises. And I think just being open-minded and going down various pathways and exploring opportunities as they come is a really exciting way to do that. And similarly, that is what defines your career as a physician. I love taking care of patients. I miss doing that in my current role right now. But in some ways, and we like to think that we're helping physicians, through our work with Thalamus, find the right residency and fellowship training programs, trying to provide research to decrease the burnout, both financial and emotional, that exists in this process, and really providing a way for them to manage that UME to GME transition so that they can ultimately find the right program and provide better patient care from that as well. So, you know, we really like to think that what we're doing will help patient care and help the profession. And I think the more we can do as physicians as a whole, as a profession, in understanding that we all have really great skills, we're all very high accomplished, achieving people, we can really do better for medicine as a whole. And that's the advice I give to each and every physician that ever asked me that.
And that's a fantastic advice. If people want to hear more about you or more about Thalamus, where can they find you?
They can find us for Thalamus on our website, thalamusgme.com, Twitter at thalamusgme. I'm on Twitter at Jason Remenick. That's probably the easiest ways to find us or find me. But yeah, we'd love to connect with anyone, be they in medical education or otherwise. But, you know, I really appreciate you having me. This has been a really great experience. And, you know, keep fighting the good fight and giving doctors advice on what to do with their careers.
Fair enough, man. Thank you. Yeah. Thanks again for coming. And yeah, keep doing what you're doing.
Appreciate it. Thanks, Andrew.
Oh, and by the way, don't forget to reach out to Panacea Financial. Panacea offers loans just for physicians and medical students with low rates, free checking with no ATM fees nationwide, and 24/7 live customer service. Visit PanaceaFinancial.com today to open your account and join a bank built with you in mind. Panacea Financial is a division of Primus, member FDIC. What an amazing show with Dr. Jason Remenick. I really enjoyed his perspective on changing GME, medical student relations and interviews, as well as how the virtual / hybrid model of residency interviews is going to unfold over the next few years. If you like this episode, please remember to go on Apple Podcasts and leave me a rating and review, and tell at least one friend. The other thing I'd like you to do after listening is visit my website at andrewtisserdo.com. That's Andrew, TisserDo.com. And subscribe to my free video series where we talk about my path from burnt out as a medical student all the way through burnt out as an attending, what I did to change it, and some actionable career strategy tips that I give you along with each video. It's completely free. Feel free to contact me at any time. And until next time, everybody, keep talking. All opinions expressed by the guest in this episode are solely the guest's opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Andrew Tisser DO, TalkToMe.LLC, or any affiliates thereof. The guest's opinions are based upon information he or she considers reliable, but Andrew Tisser DO, TalkToMe.LLC, nor any affiliates thereof warrant its completeness or accuracy. The guest, Andrew Tisser DO, TalkToMe.LLC, or any affiliates thereof are not under any obligation to update or correct any information provided in this episode. The guest's statements and opinions are subject to change without notice.